Be surreal weather here. When I get off the plane in, on Sunday, it'll be the high will be 41. So I'm going to have to bundle up while y'all are experiencing another summer here in January in Alabama. So glad to have you tonight, and I am not the teacher you need here. What you need is Brother Melvin. He's gone for the evening, and he made me promise. I wish I had not promised. He made me promise that I would cover chapter 3 of Song of Solomon. That was a mistake. I make mistakes from time to time. I made one. I am highly unprepared in the sense that, well, I've never been at a congregation that ever studied this book. Have you? I don't know what you discussed when you started, but this is how it came about. He was teaching Daniel, and I think if you've been in the class, you know what an excellent teacher he is. And I said, "What would you like to continue on Wednesday nights?" He said, "Sure." And I always take up anybody that wants to teach auditorium class. Y'all are a tough crowd. You need to know that. You spread out for one. And we thought, well, what book have we not done? And he said, "Song of," and he didn't finish the phrase. And I thought, "Oh, you're not saying that." And then we looked at each other and we thought, "But it's in the Bible." What are we going to tell God? And we said, I never read it once publicly. Or, you know, I'm sure that if you're a good Bible reader, and I'm sure many of you are, you do it privately. But here we are. And so I am hamstrung because I've never taught this. I've never studied it in depth. I spent as much time as I could between yesterday and today trying to do my job so I can finish chapter 3. But I missed, more importantly, your first two sessions in which you covered some material. I do have his PowerPoints that I went through, but I feel need 5 minutes to tell you where I'm coming from on this very unique book. Unique because the world has stolen from us several things. It has stolen marriage as an institution. It has despoiled it, robbed it of its sanctity, of its holiness. It has ruined sex, to say the least. Someone has said, of course, all cultures of ancient times from the fall have had a big problem with this issue. But we are children of the modern, of the postmodern. Those are terms that means we live after a guy called Sigmund Freud. He was the father of psychoanalysis and began doing studies on Viennese Austrian women, about 35 of them, no more than that. And based upon that research and a very small sample, he made some pronunciations and everybody bought it for a while at least. And so we live in a post-Freudian era. What that means is you and I may not study Freud. When I read him, I had to read him a little bit, and I was disgusted. But we live in an era where, ironically, everybody else can talk about this subject except us. It's surreal. And there it is, that lonely little book in the Old Testament that says, even though God's name is not mentioned at all, and that's one of two Old Testament books, Esther and the book of book Song of Solomon, which don't contain the name of God, and yet it was in the canon. Rabbis never questioned it. They had it as one of the five books that would be pulled out, scrolls, not books, but scrolls, that would be pulled out on specific Jewish holidays. And this one, Song of Solomon, written by a king 3,000 years ago, by all accounts, very few question the authenticity of it, was pulled out on the Passover feast as one of the ones that was read on the Passover feast. Now, I didn't go investigate why did the Jews do it on that particular occasion, but it's one of those five. The book of Esther was pulled out on the Feast of Purim, and the book of Song of Solomon was pulled out on this occasion. I'm a visitor tonight. Brother Melvin will be back next week, thank goodness for you, and we'll undo the damage that I'm going to do tonight, so please forgive me on this. When I entered that on BibleGateway.com to get the text, I don't know if you know, but online you've got BibleGateway.com that gives you all kinds of texts, all the English texts, plus it gives me my Italian one, Chinese. I don't read Chinese, but it gives you any text. You have to enter the right title, because otherwise you won't get the book. And so there are several titles for this one. Canticles. In the language that I grew up in Italian, it's called Cantico dei Cantici, which means Song of Songs. We know it better in, I don't know, English Standard Version and NIV, and as a Song of Solomon. That's the one that's used, but there are several titles that are used. It's poetry. A whole lot of the Old Testament's poetry. That's ennobled language. It's language that has a beat and rhythm and musicality. We are not poetry people. We are prose people. We shifted prose big time for all the big stories, narratives, themes about 400 years ago. There was a guy called Cervantes. He wrote a novel called Don Quixote. And that was the first novel of Western civilization. And since that time, we read most everything in prose. And very few of us can even do poetry. Brother Gene does poetry, and he does it very beautifully, and you should read his poems. Anybody else? Not me. I can't do poetry. I can appreciate poetry. I can read poetry. But this is in poetry. It's in poetry. And it is a drama. There's a drama. There is a, it's like a play, in a sense. I don't know a lot of drama, but I know classical drama, Greek drama. And in it, it has main characters. There are two here. And then there's a chorus. And here, there's a chorus of women. The women of Jerusalem, or there's a chorus. So it's set like in poetry, and then it has a chorus as well. And it has three major characters. Of course, the bride, she's a Shulamite. There's the King Solomon, and of course, the daughters of Jerusalem. And there are some that say, and I didn't see this in Melvin's notes, that say that the term Shulamite is a name that's a feminine form of Solomon. That may be true or not. It's not that helpful, so you can set that apart. But the setting is in the city of Jerusalem. But where the woman comes from, the Shulamite woman comes from, is the country. So there's country versus urban. There's a Galilee versus Jerusalem. She's from Galilee. She's from the countryside. She has a tan, meaning she has been outdoors working in the fields, and she is a lower class. This was true in all ancient cultures. For example, the Egyptians, the only white Africans, so to speak. If they were noble, Pharaoh's family, priests, they lived indoors, and so therefore they were very white in complexion. If, on the other hand, they worked outdoors, workmen, engineers, whatever, then they had a tan, so they were darker in skin because of that. She is a peasant that lives outdoors, a Shulamite woman, and he instead, of course, the king is a king. And that's a different story. The setting is Jerusalem, as we drop into chapter 3, and there is a procession that we're going to read about. And I wonder if you've ever seen a royal wedding. Have you seen it on TV? A royal wedding? You know, a red wedding with great pomp and circumstance, with a parade and a carriage and... I was thinking of carriages. We've got carriages in chapter 3's text twice. We've got her in a carriage. We've got him in a carriage. And his carriage is a lot fancier than her carriage, but her carriage is the one that he sent, and it's a beautiful carriage, too. My son Brandon was married, I can't remember what year because I have too many children, in Searcy, Arkansas. And I don't know about you as a parent or whatever. My wedding budget was always very low for my daughters because we live on one salary. But my in-laws on my son's side, they had put aside, they had saved, they did a little more lavish thing. And there was a Disney carriage. There was a Disney carriage. And there was ice sculptures. Have you ever been to a wedding like that? In Searcy, Arkansas, it didn't make much sense. In Disney World, maybe. But have you ever seen a procession with people lining up and the smells and the sounds, that's in chapter 3. That's coming up today as we read it in a second. This is mostly a dialogue. And in chapter 3, I think we're a little better prepared to understand who's talking, because what the text or the editors do is insert who's saying it, Solomon or the Shulamite woman. But in the real text, it's not there. So it's kind of like a guessing game. Okay, who's speaking now? Who's talking about what here? The theme and the purpose is a love song. Love was instituted by God. Marriage was instituted by God. Marriage is a God thing. Love is a God thing. All kinds of love. You know that there are five Greek words from the New Testament for love. Of course, the greatest of these is agape love, the one of 1 Corinthians 13. But there's also eros, erotic love. There's also philia, the brotherly love. There's all kinds of love. And God made us the way we are. In the book of Solomon's, the Canticle of Solomon, is tragically stolen from us as something that we can read and remember who made us physical beings with physical desires and urges and where they should be played out and what kind of feelings and emotions. The Book of Solomon is very naturalistic. It's about our human nature, and God made it. I mean, that's the thing I keep coming back to. Why are you uncomfortable reading the Song of Solomon's when this is a God thing? It's a God thing. Our culture, our sin has robbed us of the joy of simply reading it and extracting out of it. Its theme is it's about love. 70% of songs, whether it's you like country or you like classic rock or whatever you like, they're about love. Most of them, the lyrics are not that good. And they talk about love lost or love missed or something like that. This is a love song that's in the canon of the Old Testament that is about a love that's okay because God sanctions it. Now, I do have to say this. As you know from 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 6, Solomon will go on to make a lot of mistakes in years to come in his reign. We are to turn around 970 before Christ. I know that by 930 the kingdom is divided, so this belongs to the 10th century before Christ. So this song, this love poem, is 3,000 years old. And he will go on to make a lot of mistakes. How many wives did Solomon take? Do you know the number? 700. How many concubines did he go on to take? 300. That would be, yes, the math is correct, 1,000. Did God sanction that? I don't think so. Did Solomon follow the unfortunate customs of the kings of his day? Remember, the children of Israel only needed God as king. They kept wanting a king like everybody else. And Saul, the right guy for the job, ended up committing suicide because he started abusing of his and forgot to call on God. David, a man after God's own heart, still had problems and issues concerned with his power, the abuse of it, and sex too. And Solomon did too. This is not his first marriage, the one in the book of Canticle, Song of Solomon. It's not his first. Would you look in chapter 6 and verse, is it 3? Somebody tell me how many wives does he already have and how many concubines at the time of the writing of this love poem. I think it's 60 wives. Is that correct? Is there something in chapter 6 that says that? Anybody find it for me? No? Did I imagine it? I'm sorry? Verse 8, does it say 60 wives? And 80 concubines. Young women without number. Okay, I don't even know what that last thing means, okay? But I can do 60 plus 80. Is that right? So we're at 140, and he evidently doesn't learn his lesson. I am not sure. I am not sure in that context. Those may be the, I don't know. I'm not going to play guesswork because I would have to look it up and see what that Hebrew word there means, and I don't know. Mr. Melvin and I agree on how to read this thing. So the Jews said, because of its nature, said no men below the age of 30 should read this. And in the churches, in our fellowship, we don't read it at all. So how do you read this? Do you read it as an allegory of something? He and I both agree. I talked about him briefly. No, I don't think so. That's my limited study so far. I put it this as read because I think that I agree with Melvin that it should be read literally. We should take it as literal. It's a love song. It's a love song at a wedding. There is before the wedding, chapter 1 and 2, up to chapter 3 and verse 6. Then there's the parade and the beginning of the ceremony of the wedding, which lasts from chapter 3 to chapter 5. And then from 5 to 8, there's the after the wedding. In fact, I have a breakdown of that. But here is the literal view, which is the way I read it. It's a royal, and we don't have royalty anymore, but we have money and power in our time. But a royal love song. He falls in love, the king does, who's already married to many. He falls in love with a young peasant girl while she works in the fields, and he brings her to the palace and marries her. And what is contained in this love poem is the how it's supposed to be done. Not excusing 60 wives and 80 concubines, but this is how it's supposed to be. There is romantic love. God made us to fall in love. In a time when there were a lot of political arranged marriages, which is what probably caused Solomon to have many of the 700 wives that he had, which was political alliances. Unfortunately, that was part of the culture. But this one, Song of Solomon, seems to say, this is how you do it. This is how you do it. I'm sorry? I would suggest that most of them were because of his role as king. Now, he didn't have to follow the role of kings of other cultures, but he did. That's not sanctioned by God, in my opinion. Well, this is. I don't know. He did. I don't know. You know, polygamy is a fact of many of the patriarchs. And when Christ in the first century talks about divorce or remarriage, Matthew 19, to the Pharisees who are split on what to do about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, they do monogamy, but they do all kinds of stuff. He says you need to go back to the beginning. And you need to go back to the beginning. Man messed it up. And so I would suppose that God still sanctions monogamy here and that he tolerating this polygamy definitely, which is brought on by cultural influences of his time. Extremes in their time and in ours. No sex, all sex. Asceticism, which is what that word is right there, and lust. Of course, we have plenty of examples of lust today, and the only examples of asceticism that we have are, you know, monastic groups that for centuries, since the 4th century AD, have been taking vows of chastity in the name of God. That's something that has popped up within the larger Christian context. I'm going to walk through and get to chapter 3 and not miss anything. I was going to see, yes, this is kind of where we're picking up in chapter 3. The courtship is what you talked about a lot in chapters 1 and 2. I'm not going to go over them again, but I'm going to pick up at the last couple of verses of chapter 2 to go into chapter 3. So if you're there with your Bibles, I'm going to have the ESV translation up on the screen in just a moment. Falling in love, romantic love, is there in chapter 1 and 2. In a time when a lot of arranged marriages happened, falling in love, romantic love, is envisioned, sanctioned by God even, too. And this is contained in the first couple of chapters. The wedding is what we're coming up to, the procession that leads to the wedding, in the chapters that we're reading. And then you're going to see post-wedding, struggles of love, and then the last part, maturing the love. So kind of four different steps of this marriage of the Shulamite woman, a peasant that catches his eye while she's working in the field, and Solomon, the king. The other below is called in the Hebrew language, which I'm not proficient in, it's called a chiasm or chiastic. It's a organization that poetry is given, which looks like this. So this is how it goes. Look at A, B, C, and then D, and then C, B, A. So you have the bride's country roots up in the fields in Galilee. You have the growing of the love of the two for each other from a distance, in a sense. You have the bride's troubled dream, which we're reading today. You have the wedding and the wedding night, the procession, the ceremony, the wedding night, the chapters 3 and 6 through 5, 1. And we'll deal more with that. And then we have the bride's troubled dream. We have two dreams contained in this love poem. They're both by the woman. And then it comes back again to the bride remembering where she came from and her roots. So you kind of have what's called a chiasm. If you look at an X, it looks like this. And that's kind of how the Hebrew poetry plays out. Well, I'm going to break away from that to come to the text. And I think I just want to pick up with that last two verses. He said you didn't get last time to this last slide. Let me say this. Courtship is a topic that you discussed evidently either the last time or the time before. That's not very popular today. Dating is the word that's used. We got all kinds of apps for that now. There are, I guess, to keep an open mind, there's a ChristianSingles.com, which I have not been on, but I reckon I know a few that actually met through that. You can state now on the internet what are your goals for life, and some have successfully found, but I'm not sure that I would recommend it, but I don't know that I can do that, but evidently it can be useful to a certain degree. But Match.com, and let's see, what are the rest of the ones that are eHarmony, and that obnoxious dude that founded it, that seems to, compatibility, you're going to have to answer, I wanted to go on the site and see, is there anything about faith, spirituality, belief in God? Is there anything on there about that? Probably not. It's probably Freudian. It asks all the compatible. I don't know. I'm accusing falsely because I haven't been on that site. But dating, very dangerous game. I've lived in a college world for 34 years. I don't do matchmaking of my students. My wife does it. She tells people, wrong guy. Especially girls, wrong guy. She's very bold. I don't do that. I don't get into that field. But dating is a very dangerous game. Speaking as a father of four that are married and two that still have to, God help me. I got two more to get through this minefield called, I'm not going to call it dating. I've told my boys that are still in the class in there, courting. Dating is a dangerous game that only hurts people. While courting is something that is meant, geared towards marriage. And if you're not doing it for that purpose, you might not want to play that game because it has dead bodies strewn on it on the field of our American-style dating. Do you remember the dating game? Am I dating myself when I ask that question? And I do not want to go on the modern-day versions of reality TV and dating. I know there's a British one that now includes them both being completely naked. That's great. Don't you think that's advancement, progress? I go, wow, that's going to be a deep relationship for sure here. Well, let's go to the last two verses. You've been through these slides with him, and I'm not going to try to do anything else. Oop, I didn't mean to do that. I meant to go to the last slide, and I went too fast. So let me come to that last. Let's leave the last two verses of chapter 2. 16 and 17, and I think that's where you were at, yeah. My beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies. until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. Turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bethel. The bridegroom is coming to visit, and there has been expressed by her feeling of inadequacy. Her self-esteem is not so great, the Shulamite woman. Solomon, the king, says you are the most beautiful of all. Expressions for beauty for ancient cultures are different than ours. Let's see, what terms do we use now? I hear the word hot a lot, probably from sitcoms and movies. Ancient cultures used more poetic ones, like you look like a gazelle. I like that one better. The times of the New Testament, times of Jesus and Paul, both of those were single men, but they were they had terms like the Romans said of women, you have eyes like a cow, and that was an attribute of beauty. You didn't get slapped for saying that, guys. That was actually, that meant you had large eyes, you are beautiful, okay? Men, you have a nose like an eagle, aquiline. I don't think that's an attribute of our GQ models today, but that said, that was an attribute of beauty. The definition of beauty, physical beauty, changes through times and through cultures very much. And the poetic imagery that is used for these, I think is endearing, is delightful here in this particular. So let me pull it up so you can actually read it here. That's his last slide, which you told me he needed to cover. There's assurance in those last two verses. Beautiful imagery, assurance. She has felt inadequate for this handsome, powerful King Solomon, who is stricken by her. He falls in love with her. There's the beginning of the courtship. We are in the last phases of courtship here in chapter 2, beginning of chapter 3. And he has assured her, you stand out among all the women. He has assured her. And so there's this recovered sense of worth that she has in the relationship that is beginning in their courting. Please stop me anytime you have a comment. And let's go to chapter 3. So I'm going to go there and put the text up. Let me try to get out of here. There we go. And please make sure that, let's see, here we go. All right, chapter 3. Let's read the first 6 verses, if you would. Stop me if you have a comment or a question. On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I will rise now and go about the city and the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city, and have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loved. I told him and did not let him go until I brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her who conceived me. I adjure you, O daughter of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, not stir up and love until it pleases. Well, we're in the last part of the courtship, chapter 1 and 2, and now entering chapter 3. 3 and verse 6 is where the courtship, in a sense, ends, and a new phase begins, and that's a wedding ceremony as such. And this is a dream, by all accounts. It's a troubled dream, and there are two of them narrated in the love poem, one here and one in chapter 5, verses 2 through 8. And one of two dreams, and there are some scholars that are not sure whether this is real or whether it's just a dream. I've already suggested, I think Melvin agrees with me, that it's a dream that she has, and it probably still is a reflection of her insecurities and not actual events that happened to her. Coming up to the wedding, can you remember your thoughts? Your fears, can you remember? I can remember my anniversary date, and otherwise I'm gonna die. I remember that we moved up our wedding by 3 months. I remember that I didn't care what color we dressed. I remember that she had specific ideas and I had none, because maybe I was dense or something like that. But she has a dream, and it reflects her insecurities again. Insecurities about, you know, sitcoms make fun of this, you know, the uneasiness right before, the day before, the week before, you know, what if. But she has a dream in which she has been seeking, and it says, night after night, him whom my soul loves, and I gotta love that expression, grab on to these metaphors, illustrations, him whom my soul seeks, soulmate. This is different than just infatuation or this is yearn to be with, feel incomplete when you're without them. You might be gone for a week or a month or three for military service or work or whatever, but no matter how much time, there's a yearning. Him whom my soul loves. So this is not casual. This is not just sexual. It's not kind of love you feel for a family member. It's not just a close friend. It's a soulmate. True love, true companionship. You don't feel complete without them. Their courtship of the Shulamite woman and Solomon has moved to the most intense part. And this, again, is a God thing. God created our ability to feel such strong physical yearning and emotional and psychological yearning for somebody else. And maybe apart for a while because she's going to be coming into the city. This is a dream in which she doesn't know where he is, and he's been gone. And so she's going looking for him in the middle of the night in the city of Jerusalem. That's her dream. And she's going to run across guardsmen, night guardsmen. And she's going to ask where he is. And then this first dream will resolve itself quickly. She finds him. She, big hug, won't let him go, hanging on to him because she really misses him here. Some scholars ask, now, why is she having this troubled dream? And why is he not with her? Is there something else we're supposed to get out of this? But I'm not sure that we should try. Just simply, she's getting close to the wedding, and she has a dream that he's going to be gone. Yes? Oh, yes. 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 Yes, comparisons to, you know, one of the great values of coming into marriage pure is that there are no comparisons that you're going to make up in your mind between yourself and some other woman, man, date before. I mean, that's just, yes. Yeah, 100 would definitely send you for a tailspin, probably, if you're going to start that road down that road. Is this breaking up? It is breaking up. Okay, I don't know if it's me. I'll see if I'll hold this up high and maybe. Okay. All she can do is be proactive. Get out in her dream. She is not going to sit in her room and say, well, he doesn't love me anymore. She's going to get out and go find him. Get out and go find him. And that's what will happen in the dream here. Now, think of it from her perspective. Let's say you're from a rural county of Alabama, and you're in a dream in downtown Montgomery, and you don't know the roads. First time I drove to Montgomery, I couldn't find Atlanta Highway, if you believe that. That's how nincompoop I was. I kept looking for Faulkner University and couldn't find it because I couldn't find Atlanta Highway. Didn't have a GPS, by the way, at that time. She is a country girl that in her dream is lost in a city looking for a loved one. And that is a scary thought, but she does not give up until she finds him. She goes in search of him. So here's a principle that at least you can extract. Love, true love, forces us to get out of our comfort zones. And surely, if you've been married, you can testify to the value of that. We got to get out of our room. We got to get out of our head. We got to get out of our our comfort zones. For the sake of love, we're going to have to be uncomfortable. This is what the dream, for sure, as I understand it, means. She has to go out in the middle of the night in a city looking for her love, and she has success when this found it. So a deeper theme is she takes responsibility for nurturing her love by courageously walking out into the night, asking where is he at, finding him, and feeling secured by it. I don't think there's any value in discussing why does she fail to find him at first. It is true that we tend, when we're engaged, betrothed, whatever the term is, to let doubt seep in. Yes, I'm sorry. Naive in the sense of not of the higher echelons of the royal court. Is there a value to that? I don't know Solomon that well. I say that because there are some of you that are know more of his life and activities than I do. The genuine love of chapter 1 and 2 seems to transcend differences of origins. You know, she's a peasant girl, farm girl, and he's Solomon. I mean, he's tall, handsome, of course, and he's got that great gift of wisdom on top of it all. I don't think so. I don't see the class thing. She's insecure about it, but I don't see the class thing. But it could be. So, and forgive me for not seeing your hand. Sorry. Yeah, gotta love front pew people, okay? So thank you for sitting on the front pew. The professional guards don't know where he's at. That seems to throw a little kink in the... And then the dream has a good end. She finds him, and she has no intentions of losing him again. And one of the interesting things at the end of this part is the going into the mother's bedroom. Did you catch that one? What on earth is that all about? Listen to, look at, these are various scholarly options too. What does the going to the mother's bedroom have to do? Here are options. The couple is continually seeking privacy, and the mother's bedroom would be a perfect place for that. That's one scholar said. I'm going, I didn't see that. I didn't read it. Here's another one. In antiquity, a young woman would let her intended know that she was interested in being romantic with him by taking him to this room. It was a way of conveying a message without actually speaking it. Okay. Another one. In ancient times, the mother of the bride was very active in making preparations for her daughter's wedding day. I like this one better. Sometimes she prepared her own bedroom for the bride and the groom. Isaac and Rebekah consummated their marriage in his mother's tent. On Solomon's wedding day, it was his mother who crowned him. You'll see that in chapter 3 and verse 11. Okay. By the way, it's not the king's crown. A mother doesn't crown a king. That's done by a high priest. But the mother crowns it with a garland, which, by the way, was a practice that we don't do in America, right? Have you ever seen a wedding with a garland, something put on the... No? But in Europe, up to the 17th century, they actually did that. They put a garland on top, or they would have a couple underneath a garland hanging from a roof. So that tradition continued from antiquity up to this time. So I kind of like that one, too. In the last verse, what is it that she says? We're here again in chapter 3 and verse 6, that you will not arouse. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. She's talking to the chorus of women of Jerusalem. By the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or waken my love until she pleases. That last phrase seems kind of enigmatic, but I think it means this. Love takes time. Give everything time. Don't be in a hurry. Don't skip steps in a true love, pure love. Don't skip steps. Love, true love, takes time. And so make sure that you do that. Let's read verses 6 through 11, or maybe not. Let's read it just for the sake of it, and then I won't comment. But the wedding, the procession is coming up. There are her in one chariot and him in another. Here it is. We'll just read the verses and call it a night. What is it that coming up from the wilderness, like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant? Behold, it is the litter, is the couch of Solomon. He sent a carriage to get her, and she's coming into the city of Jerusalem. Around it are 60 men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords and expert in war, each with a sword in his thigh, against terror by night. King Solomon made himself a carriage from the wood of Lebanon. Now you're switching to see King Solomon waiting for her. Her carriage is coming in with all these 60 men and with all these smells. And then there's Solomon waiting in his carriage. And then it describes his carriage: posts of silver, back of gold, seat of purple. Its interior was laid with love. He did it with his own hands, built it by the daughters of Jerusalem. Get out, O daughter of Zion. Look upon the King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. Brother Melvin will be back next Wednesday, and he'll try to fix the mess I made. All right. Thank you for being here.